Well, we know what it's like to feel worried and helpless about the state of our world.
But we're finding comfort and inspiration from people tackling winner-take-all economics and other root causes of climate change, inequity, and global unrest.
Join us on the road from wasteland to wonderland. This is Pot of Gold.
Please keep in mind that these recordings may not be as high quality as they usually are because we're doing them in a time of social distancing.
We talk about climate change a lot on this podcast. We haven't really talked about how bad the situation actually is.
The truth is, time has run out. Even if we stop releasing greenhouse gases completely, we've already done too much damage to the atmosphere to stop drastic changes to our climate.
If this planet's going to make it, we have to turn the clock back. And that's exactly what Sebastian and Lars Graf are doing with their new startup, True Carbon.
Through True Carbon, Sebastian and Lars are trying to incentivize farmers to use techniques that actually capture carbon and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and store them in the Earth's topsoil. Let's let Sebastian and Lars elaborate.
Hi, my name is Sebastian Graf. I'm the founder of True Carbon. We're working to try and remove as much CO2 from the atmosphere as possible to end climate change with effective techniques for this and scientific techniques. My background isn't originally in climate science or in what I'll be talking about, carbon farming. I'm a robotics engineer and spent most of my time building and tinkering solutions to mechanical and electrical problems in the garage. So I'm here with Lars Graf, my father, who's a co-founder on this company. And if you want to give...
Sure. I help Sebastian on the financial side as a interim CFO to make sure the finance is all straight and how the investments get properly transacted. My background is I'm actually a Silicon Valley software entrepreneur. I started a number of companies in the 90s and the 2000s in the area of network and security management and developed a couple of core technologies. I'm very familiar with building companies from the idea at the dining table to building reproducible revenue models where you can actually, you know, put a quarter in and get a buck out. And so I'm helping basically Sebastian get launched in the process and also help a little bit develop and advance the management team as it's developing through the different company stages. That's really my expertise.
So exactly what is carbon farming and what is the concept?
So there has been quite a lot of public support for climate change research, especially after Greta Thunberg and all of this last year. Myself personally, I was in the position to start looking for a new career after 2018, I guess. Me and a group of scientist friends started really thinking about how can we affect climate change with our careers? Like, what parts of this are really so unsolvable that we're unable to do anything? And what we found was that there is massive gaps in sort of the public understanding and awareness of what climate change really is and what point we are in that process. So what we're kind of at the point of is there is no amount of efficiency projects. That there's no amount of less driving, not flying, not burning coal that will return the clock and stop us from going over a cliff on this. We are I think it was about 2014, past the point of no return, and we have to remove carbon from the air or remove GHGs from the air in order to make effective turnaround of climate change. So this has to happen on top of all of the other efficiency projects that need to be happening in the world. And currently, the vast majority of people, when you ask at conventions, what are things that remove carbon from the air, they end up getting into planting trees and getting into, even sometimes on the technical side saying, hey, there's these new technologies to direct air capture, remove carbon from the air. And so we started looking into these different technologies and kind of where the best, cost to performance we can get in removing large amounts of greenhouse gases from the air. And it turned out that it wasn't anything particularly fancy. It was way, way larger scale than we had ever anticipated. There is a technique for removing carbon dioxide from the air and putting it into soils. And it's been the process of soil regeneration for hundreds of years. Farmers who over-fertilize or over-cultivate their soils tend to see carbon loss and more sandy soils over time. Farmers who practice carbon farming or practice soil regeneration tend to get that carbon back into their soils. And across the world, we've seen farming techniques go more and more industrial and lose more and more of this carbon content in the soil. And it turns out that we can capture the majority of the world's emissions directly in this soil, essentially infinitely. We can continue to build on topsoil throughout the next couple hundred years without really running out of space. And this is really advanced science and really advanced stuff that is kind of hard to get into, but the gist of it is that plants and funguses and bacteria all have co-beneficial relationships with each other, and we have to make sure that those stay alive. Every time you till the land, whenever you see a farmer with a tractor plowing and folding one part of the soil over onto top of the other, he is actually emitting large amounts of methane and CO2 from that soil. And this is one of the primary ways that we lose that carbon content in soils. So there are plenty of farming techniques, such as stubble planting and other types that don't use this to degrade the land. Basically, we want to produce a certificate and a scheme for farms to have financial incentive to keep their ground fertile and keep their carbon footprint in the negative side rather than positively emitting it. So carbon negativity is a terrible word for PR, but it's the negative carbon emissions is how you would read it about it in the scientific studies.
So how do those incentives work? What is this incentive structure has worked for, if you can give us an example, and what do you see happening going forward?
You want to take this on for
Sure. I mean, basically, what we need to do is we need to mobilize economic forces in combination with government regulation forces to do that. It actually has to be a two-pronged approach. Okay, and in the end, you're a farmer. You need to maximize and get income from your land. So you can do it through multiple methods. You can build things. You can put corn on that, which goes into biogas, for example. Or you can actually commit to doing certain scientifically proven practices that bring carbon out of there into the soil. Okay, so that has to be measured. There have to be measurement technologies that say per acre or per hectare of soil, this much tonnage for this farmer under these practices have to be done. So there's a certification and trust process, just like we have it with bioproducts or organic products worldwide. Okay, and based on that, one can issue certificates saying so many tons per carbon have been generated, have been taken out of the air, and these can be then sold to companies that are actually looking to be carbon neutral or to be positive in their whole impact on the climate. So you have a very simple thing. You have to find a way to certify and then bring money from the market of carbon certificates and put it into the hands of the farmers to give them the incentive to do so. That requires, of course, some government regulations and help with it, but that's the essence. And if we can do this, there's a tremendous leverage. I don't know what the numbers are, but it's like nearly like 100 gigaton per year that could be theoretically being sequestered into the soil worldwide. And that is out of the 500 gigatons that is required worldwide to be taken out of the air. So the potential is tremendous. And so what is the biggest market of the future? The biggest market of the future is climate change. Okay, there's remediation, there's fixing, and there's also changing it. And this is where we are. And so we're trying to bring capital, entrepreneurial technology and methodologies to it to solve a worldwide problem and give the income to farmers, bring a market, and of course, you know, maybe a little bit successful, make a little money along the way.
Wow. So measure, certify, reward, and save the world, essentially.
And rinse and repeat.
Rinse and repeat. And now you're talking that this process could take approximately a fifth to a fourth of the carbon each year out of.
That's a global number. So there was a study by Ohio State University on global capture rates for carbon emissions. Or for carbon sequestration. And at a global scale, if 100% of current cropland and grazing land were to be converted to carbon capture techniques, you could do about 123 billion tons of carbon, so 123 gigatons of carbon. But that's worldwide, and that's a rough estimate. That's been also criticized for some of its inaccuracies on that too. But there, in essence, if you could get 20% of farms, which could be all of the farms in the Western world, to do it, you would have 100% of human emissions captured per year. So if you can make this a Western world problem rather than trying to push it onto, you know, as many third world countries as possible, which is basically what we're at. Most emissions trading happens on projects in third world countries. If we could take this on ourselves and not only be an example, but have the capability to start removing some of the rest of the emissions that we don't currently look at, we would end up with net zero much faster than if we were trying to nitpick and make everyone feel shameful for these things, because it's kind of been proven at this point that shame is a pretty bad motivator. It's one of the reasons politically we are in the state in the US that we're in, because a lot of those voters don't want to move away from what is considered to be a pretty shameful position in that party and in that situation in the States. I mean, companies don't want to tell you how much they are currently emitting because it's shameful, and they want to cover all of that up as much as possible. And cap and trade does not remove carbon from the air. It just simply says that this country commits to not going over this amount, and then tries to produce a economic market for companies to be like, well, okay, we need to burn this amount of coal, so we have to buy that many certificates of that. And overwhelmingly up to this point, it's pretty much failed. We're hoping that with new additions to cap and trade over the next few years, and even things that were implemented 2 years ago, that we're going to see some changes in that market. But fundamentally, at this moment in time, there is no industry that you can funnel billions of euros into to take CO2 out of the air.
So that's a point of confusion for me. This idea of cap and trade versus what you're speaking about, which is kind of trading on your savings of carbon, right? Or the way you've removed carbon. Can you kind of clarify that difference? Because we've heard all kinds of negative news about cap and trade, that it's not effective, it doesn't work. But you're proposing something different, but I'd like to sharpen that distinction.
Maybe take a crack at the question, because I have to tell you, I was really confused myself when Sebastian told me about this. Okay, so I'm actually somebody who likes to sail on boats on the ocean. Okay, and for me, the difference between cap and trade and the certificates of sequestration, for me to really make simple is the following. Okay, if I have a hole in the boat below the waterline, my boat will keep sinking. Period. There is no way of stopping it. It will go down. End of story. Okay. So if I have a big hole, I can make that hole smaller, but my boat will still keep sinking. Inevitably, nothing about it. So just making the hole smaller doesn't prevent us from sinking. What we actually have to do is it's called a bilge pump. We have to literally pump the boat back out get the water. We have to pump the boat out to get the water out of the boat. They do it by bucket or by pump. It has to get out, okay? And that is the only way. So yes, we need to make the hole in the boat smaller so that less water comes into the boat, meaning we have to emit less, so we have to take less out. But in the end, the only way we can keep the boat and our climate and our ecosystems from sinking is by taking the carbon and taking it out of the atmosphere. Okay, and that's really what carbon sequestration is. And for what I can see is the regenerative agriculture is really the most effective way to do it, and quite possibly the most cost effective, because we need both volume and scalability, and it has to be economically feasible.
Can we go a little dark on this? Because, you know, everyone basically says we're on a clock, we're running late. And I think people really don't have a clear vision of what climate change looks like when it's in full mode, full swing. And we're seeing more fires, we're seeing more hurricanes, we're seeing more earthquakes, we're seeing, you know, a lot of different small patches of damage around the world. What does it look, what are we scaring everyone about? What does it look like?
What ends up happening is entire ecosystems get wiped out. You have algae blooms that will literally kill every living thing in them because they just overproduce certain toxins that nothing can live in. You'll have very competitive new species in places they've never been before that completely wipe out the native, you know, agriculture and native species that were there. So this is kind of the first thing. I mean, just recently, if you've seen what's happening with locusts in Africa right now, I mean, this is record-breaking stuff. You end up with most of those farms, most of those places will just be eaten away entirely. And there's not a whole lot you can do about it, because that's one of those competitive species. It's one of the things that comes in and makes the most out of that situation. So, I mean, real wrath of God kind of stuff, Old Testament stuff is actually pretty much on the horizon. Frogs, locusts, jellyfish, you know, fire and thunder from the sky. This is all possible things in the next few years. And every year we've been hitting new record high temperatures. And I mean, we've talked about 2 degrees is kind of like this scary number in science, but, you know, many cities are going to go way above 2 degrees Celsius in their new record highs. You'll be able to, you know, fry an egg in latitudes that never used to, on the street, fry an egg on the top of your car in places that would have never imagined that before.
So, Sebastian, you talked about gaps in, I guess, data information in the beginning. There are massive gaps in information, massive gaps of maybe knowledge. So we have new technology and we can use it in order to inform us. And it seems part of that new technology or technology in general is being used in order to hide stuff from us. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that and how, like, for example, how in Christian's case, in his app about the air pollution, that he comes down with his app to basically that everyone can check what is the air quality in your street, and then you can make a decision for yourself, sort of from large scale, you know, we talked very big numbers to down to the individual user. Can you talk a little bit about that in your venture?
Yeah, there's actually a really big social part in my venture that that makes the most sense on this level. So just as there was certification for organic or bio in Europe, there is going to be a carbon negative certification on foods, a label showing the amounts either emitted or captured by specific things in the store. And so on a personal level, there are going to be quite a few brands in the next couple of years showing that they are doing the maximum that they can for consumers to make this. And what I hope to see is that there's a standardization that actually holds these brands accountable for those numbers, and that consumers can trust in the fact that they will be able to pick up a bag of rice or oats and the negative 10 kilograms that were, you know, taken out of the air by that bag can be trusted and move forward. So you can move towards fully opaque carbon negative diets. So that would be awesome, and that's one of those things. But to hint to sort of the darker side of this is that there is a lot of self-regulation happening in this industry. A lot of really big companies, and some of them that most people have never heard of, but I don't know if you've heard of Cargill. Cargill is one of the largest farming companies on Earth, and possibly, at least from what the U.S. Congress says, one of the darkest and most evil companies on Earth as well. Huge amounts of rainforest burned, huge amounts of stuff. They're the primary supplier for companies like McDonald's and Starbucks and massive food chains. If you need a billion tons of pretty much any type of food, Cargill is pretty much the only supplier you have. So Kraft, a whole bunch of these guys. So the challenge is that they are also seeing this particular carbon negative industry as being their next big moneymaker. And so many of these brands are now poised to start making claims, which are going to be really hard to back up with science. So there's this entire kind of dark side to trying to do science correctly, that it's expensive and time consuming and requires regulation to get the true data out there. And most industries that are sort of self-regulated don't give good data. I mean, no scientist out there who isn't held up to peer review has trustworthy data, essentially. So one big example of this is that's really not talked about is the oil industry. How many kilograms of CO2 or methane or any GHGs are emitted per liter of oil at the pump? You know, we always think about what our cars consume, but what is the actual amount that those oil companies need to produce that single liter? And so most of the mobility sector's numbers are completely skewed in gasoline's favor today. Because when you go and measure carbon emissions from hydrogen fuel sources, or you measure it for electrical fuel sources, it always goes into the production of that fuel. But in gasoline, it's completely dark. You literally cannot get numbers from those companies about how much carbon emissions that company produced to make that 1 liter of gasoline. And that's due to bad regulation. That's due to, you know, fixing in so many of these industries and the science being bad. And we have a real problem right now coming up, that the cheapest carbon negative foods may be more or less self-regulated, may be more or less done by these huge multinational companies that most people will have never heard of and won't question whether or not the claims made are correct.
It's basically a big issue of trust and whether I as a consumer can trust that this data is used correctly. And what I'm hearing from you now is that most companies at the moment kind of greenwash data and use it whatever they wanted to use in order to look good. But in the background, they basically do what they want in the name of profit.
Yep.
That's basically motivation.
And charging more for the same product.
I see the evolution very similar that we have here in the carbon certification of products that we have had in bio and organic in the United States as well in Europe. Okay, I remember the time when the USDA was negotiating for the organic label and what to do. And so before that, it was a lot of interest groups because consumers wanted to have organic. There was no definition of what organic was. So everybody created little groups with more or less trust on saying we are organic, and they got very different labels. And then it became such a big industry that there was a demand for regulation and for uniformity in it. And that's when the Department of Agriculture tried to do that. And there were even also very strong pushback from certain groups that wanted to actually include literally toxic waste as part of fertilizer for organic foods. I mean, there were absolutely amazing things that were tried to done. We're in the same story right now. We're in the really, really early stage of the first consumer saying, hey, I think organic or bio in Europe would be good. Okay, beginning awareness. We need to first create consumer awareness. And when consumer, this I think may happen really quickly because it's like a wildfire spreading in some cases, literally wildfires in California and other places. Okay, so when consumers say we want it, then there will be groups that say we will certify the content of carbon content of products. And when that happens and there's enough market, enough certification, we will have regulations just like we have with the European bio brands. And this is a very, very normal evolution. Let's hope it doesn't take us 20 or 30 years. Let's hope it takes us maybe 5, 7, 10 years, and we will all be better off. And then consumers can make choices. Then we have market mechanisms at work that become self-regulated, just like we have it in the bio and organic field.
I would like to tap into your personal motivation to do this, Sebastian. I think you told me when we first met and talked about it the first time about your startup, and then I realized, oh my God, he's got a real personal motivation behind this. Do you remember?
Yeah, I have a very strong ethical pull for myself, and I really feel that there's only so many generations that we can, you know, put these huge huge scale problems onto. And having grown up with these kinds of large scale problems in my future and seeing how people around me feel about this, I'm not sure that it's ethical for me right now to put that onto my kids or to put that into the future onto another generation until there's at least, you know, a little bit more light at the end of the tunnel to make that. And so this has been one of the bigger motivations. I'm really questioning, you know, can I in the next 10 years ethically have kids with the current state of the world, or will we have to go through quite a lot of change? And how much change can I personally implement to make that future a reality?
Is there any like a last message from you two? Could be a personal one, something you which is really close to your heart. You really would like to say and bring it out there.
I think that the main message I'd like to have out there is that there is hope. That I started out in such a dark place, not really believing that there was much hope for most of my life. And finding this particular technique, carbon farming, and looking at the scalability of this, really changed my opinion on how dark this can be. There's so many challenges along the way, but I am massively uplifted by the fact that this is now starting to move in that direction. And we are seeing so many companies, so many industries, so many things looking at this as being a real opportunity.
I have to tell you, I guess a retired executive, I'm so impressed with some of the young people, you know, in their late teens and their mid-20s, that is so much potential there, okay, that I deal with and that I help nurture and try to enable. But it is truly amazing. I mean, we're talking about the next Jobs and Wozniaks out there, okay? And what you've seen through Tesla, a single person can make a worldwide difference. If we just help these young people and enable them, amazing things can happen. And like I said, I've been truly stunned at the capacities of the next generation that comes out. The ones that have not given up, and they're truly amazing.
What a wonderful note. Thank you so much.
I love Sebastian's motivation to actually do this as a young, engaged man who obviously has the brains to do all the research and like to come up with a solution and to talk about it in these very open and engaged way and very still be hopeful. You know, I think that's the key, you know, still optimistic, I guess that's the word.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we have an innate need to think about the prospects of our children. Even if our own kids are going to do well and the rest of the world doesn't do well, we're in trouble. So we all have to think about sustaining kind of universal well-being, a world that really does support all the people on the planet in order for ourselves to survive. And, you know, it's really great that people, young people, are coming up with these kinds of solutions.
And the dads who are supporting them.
Yeah, true. But I mean, honestly, it's imperative. And that's the hope, is that we do come up with new solutions, because we have to. What is the alternative, honestly?
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer,